were. He isn't supposed to harm them in front of the others. They've been careful in the past not to scare the animals. This will make their care and feeding much more difficult. The chimp moans as its compatriots beat on their glass. It's crying. It's not even well sedated, probably because Kumbili lacks Dick's veterinary training. Oi! Dick steps from the corner. What the bloody hell is this? Kumbili raises his hands, as though the rifle is being pointed at him, a skin-fusing iron in his grip. He doesn't speak, and Dick can't read his expression through the surgical mask.
Did you fucking hear me, mate?
The chimp on the operating table languidly raises a hand, questing towards some unseen object in the air. It's not paralyzed.
Shit, Dick mutters. Step back.
Kumbili has just long enough to mumble a confused reply before his patient bellows and snatches off half of his face. In that instant, time slows down. Kumbili goes stumbling backward, hands rising, not fully aware of the cause of his newfound pain. The chimp kicks off the table, enraged, and its intestines come spilling out. Dick fires a shot, hitting it squarely in the chest. It still comes for him, entrails dangling, painting the floor a brilliant red, like the stroke of some massive brush. One bullet is never enough when the target is committed. He pops it twice more, and it trips from the blood loss, drugs, and guts, sliding into his feet, and then going still. Kumbili crouches in the corner, his screams merging with those of the chimps. 10. Service and servers. The station has a med bay, right outside the crew quarters module, though Blue has rarely had occasion to use it. Her room is equipped with most of the advanced technology she needs for her complex daily care. She hasn't been to a real hospital in years. So it feels strange to her to be standing in the med bay over Kumbili's bed, his face so bandaged that only one eye and part of his mouth are visible. She's fatigued, and the connection to Marcus's body lacks its usual sparkle. Her brain can't buy the illusion that she's a healthy, safe person. Phantom pains crisscross her chest, and she finds herself coughing for seemingly no reason at all. Her real body is a dream. Marcus's body is the truth. It has to be, because she refuses to live her final days fading away like a pathetic husk. Because looking at Kumbili, she knows her work will be put on hold, and she'll soon be fired. He coughs, and she instinctively reaches out to touch his hand. It's a stupid gesture. Marcus's skin, though warm, feels wrong somehow. No one would take comfort in his touch. No one except Anne. And Blue feels certain that's some kind of fetish. Glitter Edifice could have been something great. It could have been the cure for all genetic disease. It could have ushered in a new era of medical miracles. It could have been Blue's ticket back to a wonderful life, full of press interviews and symposiums. Her intellectual property might have belonged to the company, but the book deals and film rights would have been worth a fortune. She'd have been set for life. A much longer life. Plagiarus Pripitens is the ultimate builder, able to rewrite and reconstruct organic matter in seconds. It should have built her a brighter tomorrow. She'd never bought into the foolish company vision of a weaponized snatcher. It was as if she'd split the atom, and all they wanted were nuclear bombs. Kumbili stirs beneath her, and his mouth makes a clicking, gurgling noise. It must taste like penny syrup inside there. Blue knows the sensation well. One of his hands rises to point to his half-exposed lips. She leans down so she can hear him better.
This,
he slurs, his voice hoarse and broken from screaming.
This is your fault.
Blue steps back, eyes wide.
What? Was trying to prep next sample.
His voice is barely a whisper, but Marcus's perfect ears hear every detail.
You rushed me. Threatened me. You should have been there.
I didn't have a choice, Kambili. Suddler is a problem. I needed you to prep the chimp ASAP.
Because you're dying.
He laughs, falling into bitterness.
Now I have no face. Why is your life worth more than mine?
She frowns. No one has ever said that to her.
This isn't just my life or your life. If I'm right, this could change the entire shape of genetic research. Call it whatever you want, you selfish bitch.
Her sympathy evaporates.
You should have been more careful.
Get out, he whispers. Kambili. He tries to sit up, despite the sedatives in his system.
Get out.
The words are muffled by the bandages around his mouth, and his voice cracks. He falls back to his gurney, groaning and sobbing. Blue turns to leave, only to find Lucy in the doorway, staring at her with hollow eyes.
What the fuck did you say to him? She asks.
But Blue walks past her without answering. There's no way for that discussion to go well, so she dodges it altogether. She prays she won't see Suddler when she walks into the hall, or Anne, or Dick, or anyone else for that matter. She doesn't have the strength to deal with all of the recriminations. She's read Dick's report of the incident, filed on the re-imaged SCIF computers. Other than the startup logs, it's the first entry on the new system. She knows how it will look. It's another major accident in 2 days. They'll send her project into suspension if they don't shut it down altogether. She's doomed. Lab techs dodge her in the hall. Dick's facilities guy gives her the stink eye. She passes Josip talking anxiously with his trio of engineers, and he gives her a guilty look, like he's the one with something to hide. Yet he's the only project manager who hasn't royally fucked up. She needs to get back to her lab, but she has no plan. She'll figure it out when she gets there. Maybe she can access her logs. Maybe she can perform the Noxidria experiment by herself. Maybe she should just tell Suddler what she's doing, and hope for the mercy of the Weyland-Yutani Governance Board. It'll take weeks, though. It could take years. Blue is almost back to the skiff when Daniel flags her down. Like everyone, he shows signs of stress, but they're subtle. His easy, commanding smile is a little slower, the creases of his eyes a little more pronounced. He hasn't put his clothes through the ironing machine, and he's the only crew member who cares about that sort of thing.
The skiff is closed until further notice, he says. Before you ask, it's on my authority.
So I don't need to go kicking Suddler's ass? He smirks.
I wouldn't recommend it. Things are tense enough.
She puts her hands on her hips and looks down at the deck with a sigh.
Please, just let me in. I've still got work to do.
Daniel sucks his teeth.
You know I'm charged with everyone's safety. This is a major accident. Sometimes you science types get ahead of yourselves, and it's my job to rein you in. This is for your own good.
She shuts her eyes.
Fuck that, Dan. Please just let me in. I need to feed the chimps.
He arches an eyebrow.
That's Dick's job. And since the mishandling of those animals is what got us into this situation, I will not authorize that.
She points to her head.
Remember? I've got two faces and the grip strength of a power loader. I can handle myself.
He folds his hands behind and spreads his legs to shoulder width.
the classic military at-ease posture. She won't be passing him. I said no, Blue. Fine, she says, shaking her head with gritted teeth. That's just fucking great. Without another word, she heads back to the crew quarters. These bastards are going to kill her. Reaching the end of the long strut, she enters the corridor with all the crew rooms. At the end of the hall, she spies the sign for the observatory, and glares. Nothing had been on schedule. Nothing was according to plan, and yet everything seems so much worse now that Dorian Suttler is here. She wishes him a stroke, or an aneurysm. She wishes the glass would fail in his room, sucking him out into the scorching vacuum beyond. She wishes she could trade bodies with him, her failing form his only anchor. Blue has never hated anyone so much in her whole life, and that's before Anne backs out of his room, pushing disheveled hair back into place. The physicality of an android body prevents true anger. Marcus has no heart to race, no breath to quicken. His is a cold fury, with calculating eyes and quick synapses. Blue sometimes fears his inhuman strength and the things she might do with it. Instead, she stops in her tracks, narrowing her eyes. Really, Anne? How stupid are you? Anne glances back at her and freezes, wounded. She juts out her lower lip, her arms tensing with the muscles Blue had once caressed. I don't want to do this with you right now. Blue gives her a wry grin. Why would you? You just did it with Dorian. Anne closes the distance between them with remarkable alacrity and bares her teeth at him. You know something, Blue? You need to figure out how to make some friends really fast. I don't fucking belong to you, so don't pull this macho shit on me. Blue gestures to the door. But him? What is wrong with you? She watches Anne's jaw muscles work in her slim cheeks, and her irises contract. Maybe I just wanted to feel alive for once, she hisses. She storms off, and Blue lets her pass with eyes downcast. For no rhyme or reason, it still hurts. Those nights they'd spent together were her first to feel like a normal human since her diagnosis. Maybe she did love Anne Wexler. Blue shakes the thought away as soon as it rears its ugly head, because she can't let it be true. She can't let anyone into her heart anymore. With a bitter flood of emotion, she passes numbly into her quarters to see herself lying on the bed. The brain direct mask flickers across her eyes, and a glimmering tendril of drool leaks from the side of her mouth. She's so emaciated and pockmarked. She's disgusting. It's like staring into a mirror and finding only a gloomy, malformed reflection of the self. What if Blue takes Marcus's hands and smashes her skinny little throat? What if she takes the tranquilizers designed to help her sink and injects 20 cc's of them into her intravenous drip? If she smashed her mirror and took a shard to her wrist, would she feel it, connected as she was to Marcus? She imagines the blazing pain as it slices into her wrists and watching herself drain out. Would it be any worse than the slow death of Bashara's syndrome? Reaching out, she lifts her own hand, dizzied by the sensation of holding her flesh and being held. She shouldn't be here. Shouldn't be alive. No one else with the syndrome made it past age 30. Her mobile terminal beeps and she lets go, a wrist flopping to the bed. Blue takes the terminal from its charging station and keys in her password. There's a picture inside her mailbox and she opens it. It's Silky, her old cat from Earth, the one she gave away at the start of her tenure on the Cold Forge. The address is scrambled. Marcus is calm, but she hears her body suck in a breath.
She searches out her cipher drive from her mattress and plugs it into the side of the terminal. It references the picture in the one-time pad. A message appears. Elise Kodo gone. We are still listening. Give us your research. We can extract you. Elise is blown. Her assets will be seized. At this point, it's far more likely that the sender of this message is a company agent who's gotten control of Elise's side of the one-time pad. But then, does it matter? What are they going to do? Kill her? Blue encrypts a message into a picture of a grinning cousin at the beach. I am in. How? 2 difficult days pass, and Blue is a ball of nervous energy. Whoever her mysterious benefactor is, they haven't responded to her question. She imagines the Weyland-Yutani fraud investigators back on Earth, laughing and building a case around her confession. Is there such a thing as entrapment in a situation like this? It won't matter. Her court hearing will take at least 6 months after she arrives home. She'll be dead long before the lawyers can decide what to do with her. Unlike Elise, she has no family, no one to destroy. Blue needs to get back into the skiff so she can take the drives out of her server and stash them somewhere, anywhere. She has partial genetic sequences of larval snatchers, as well as the Noxidria facehuggers. While it's not a clean sample of Plagiarus pripitens, the sequences are still valuable to investors. Do her confederates have eggs? Can they get a clean sample? Anne is her best way back into the skiff. The other project managers won't help her. Daniel has already made his allegiances clear. As much as Blue doesn't want to face her, Anne is the only one who can give her a fighting chance. It's lunchtime. The crew should be in the lounge, chowing down on the food she'd like to eat. She'd stopped going to the lounge after they'd implanted the G-tube in her stomach, taking the one thing she could eat in her quarters. Gelatin. Watching everyone else chew would ignite pangs of longing inside her beyond any unrequited love she'd ever felt. And every time the conversation turned to how shitty the food was, Blue would find herself infuriated with her crewmates. She'd give anything to be like them again. Easy and carefree. Sometimes she would eat with them as Marcus, but the acute senses that made him so intoxicating with Anne made the food unbearable. Experienced through his senses, her meals were no longer a blend, but sorted into a dozen discrete characteristics, each amplified beyond the capacity for a human brain to process. Sometimes Blue would take a pinch of sugar into Marcus's mouth, because it was the only thing that translated well. Perhaps if Marcus's brain-direct interface wasn't a hacked-together solution, she'd be able to taste morsels like the others. Maybe she could be in there bitching with them about the quality. The thing Blue misses the most about eating, however, is the conversation. Yet she can't simply sit and stare while the others gorge themselves. They become awkward if she watches them. So much of a day, so many worries and hopes are shared around a meal. She's been excluded from all of that. Maybe that's why no one likes her anymore. She isn't part of the campfire circle that's existed since the dawn of humanity. Reaching the lounge door, she pauses. They'll assume she's there on business and be annoyed with her for even showing her face. Maybe she could choke down a meal to get back in the good graces of her crewmates, then see if Anne will speak to her in private. Would that look desperate? The door opens, and she scans the room, spotting a few of the lab techs, but no project managers. There's a ping-pong table in the back corner where some of the crew congregate, obstructed by the serving buffet. Anne likes it over there. It's one of the only sports where she can beat Blue's synthetic body. When Blue rounds the corner, she finds Dorian Suttler staring at her, eyes shining, wearing a grin far friendlier than he deserves. He sits holding a pair of chopsticks over a plate of steaming teriyaki noodles, the kind she would kill for if she could still have them.
Dr. Marcellus, he says. I didn't expect to see you in the lounge. He gestures to Marcus's body. I didn't know you're type 8. You know, food. I can. I don't, though. She returns as much of his smile as is required by decorum. I was looking for someone. Oh, who is it? Maybe I've seen them. It's fine, she says. Just Commander Cardozo. Sudler digs into his noodles, and Marcus's olfactory receptors deliver her the salt, wheat, and umami scents she cannot enjoy. She briefly fantasizes about slamming his head into the plate so hard that the table snaps from its mounting brackets. Placing a clump of noodles in his mouth, he chews with relish, then swallows. Sad to say that he's still in the skiff. Lots of cleanup to do after this past week. How long before we can return to work, Director? I was getting somewhere with my project, and maybe you'd like to brief me on that. She flexes her fingers to avoid making a fist. I'd rather have some results before I do. He picks through the noodles, looking for bits of meat. Finding one, he pops it into his mouth. You know, Doctor, any progress would be a result for Glitter Edifice. I can take you over there now, and you can show me what you've learned. She bites her lip. I'm not ready yet. Okay, well, let me know when you are. Meanwhile, I'm sure you've got a number of tasks outside the skiff you can attend to. Sure, she nods. Okay. He regards her for a long moment while he consumes another strand of sticky noodles. She wants to leave, but he looks as if he's going to speak again. Can I ask you? He mumbles, taking a swig of water in order to speak more clearly. What got you into genetics? That takes her by surprise, and she casts her thoughts back. Blue's uncle died suddenly when she was only 8 years old. One day he was fine, and the next his immune system turned against him, destroying his skin and respiratory system. The medical community had created gene therapies for multiple sclerosis, Tay-Sachs disease, Parkinson's, and numerous others, but those took time. There still was no rapid response system for cases like his, and colonists like him were at particular risk for one-off genetic disorders. She wanted to help the colonists and stop future cases like her uncle's, but she'll be damned if she shares any emotional memories with Sudler, though. I was smart enough to be a doctor, she replies, and gene sequencing was paying better than it ever had before. He nods, taking it in. So when you were in college, you didn't, you know about your condition. She hates it when people ask her that. The medical press found it particularly entertaining. No. That's so amazing. How fortunate that you have that training. It's almost as good as being born with a real life expectancy. Sorry. He says, that smiling mask never falling from his face. Didn't mean to hit a nerve. It's fine, she lies. Please let Daniel know I'm looking for him, would you? Before he can speak again, she turns and leaves. When she reaches her room, she glances over to his door. He'd only just started eating and won't be back for some time. If he's going to shutter her project, she may as well find out who else is getting the shaft. She taps the open key, and the door slides aside, allowing her passage into the observation room. Guess you ought to rethink your open door policy, fucker, she mutters, passing inside. She had always imagined Sudler to be a meticulously clean man, given his spotless appearance and pressed suits. She finds, instead, two folding easels and a mess of paints, filthy papers and old brushes and palette knives. Against the backdrop of Kaufman's light, the whole place strikes her as bohemian.
Coming to one of his canvases, she scowls. It's a pleasing mishmash of angles and geometric shapes. A decent imitation of a Georges Braque. Does he haul this shit all over the galaxy? When he's ruining lives, does he retire for a nice, relaxing painting session? Clearly, the answer is yes. Mixed into the shapes, she sees the curve of Anne's body, clearly outlined in burnt umber, shading to orange starlight. Back in her own body, Blue wants to throw up. But of course, that could kill her. Instead, she turns away and looks for Dorian's personal terminal. It's not hard to find among the clutter of painting supplies. She lifts open the screen, and the Weyland-Yutani login shield pops up. Suttler probably thinks Blue can't code or hack because of her background as a geneticist. He'd be wrong. She's written thousands of programs and has set up massive server farms. She wrote the program to open and close the heat shields on the kennels. That was disastrous, but it gave her unique insight into the Cold Forge's IT and DevOps policies. Thus, she knows all of the exploits for his system, and bypasses the login screen with little trouble, reaching a directory listing of encrypted files. In the event someone dies or quits, the company has to be able to decrypt the contents of their drives. She has the master keys, because she exported them from the skiff without permission after she wrote the behavioral modification code for the kennels. Blue grabs copies of the most recent 100 files, all small, so most likely documents or spreadsheets. She drops them onto a portable drive and deposits that in Marcus's pocket, then powers down the system. In and out in under 5 minutes, and when she leaves, the corridors are empty. She makes it the short distance back to her room with no difficulty, since the bastard decided to be her neighbor. Sometimes she thinks he intentionally did it to annoy her, though only a creep would do something so ridiculous. In seconds, she's back to her own terminal, with the stick plugged in and master decryption cracking open Suttler's files. Some of the file names are a little scrambled, but she selects the top one, a spreadsheet. It's a personnel rotation report, and it lists everyone on the station as slated for termination, with a recommendation for fresh blood all around. Blue smiles. This is her ace in the hole. Marcus's firm hand presses against her shoulder, gently rousing Blue from slumber. She sucks in a breath and blinks the sleep from her eyes. This past month, her left eyelid has become sluggish and unwilling to respond. You have some visitors. She smacks her lips, her mouth sticky with dried saliva. She checks the time. It's the middle of the night cycle. Send them away, she croaks. I'm not decent. I'm afraid they're quite insistent. It's the commander. That perks her up. Okay. Plug me in. Marcus takes the brain direct interface from its place at her bedside and gently settles it over her shaved scalp. She can always tell when the connection is successful, because his ears can detect the hiss of her oxygen tanks, while hers cannot. When she'd first arrived, she insisted on being in her motorized wheelchair to meet visitors. Now it sits idle in the corner of her room. She spends more time inside Marcus than she does inside herself, and every time she comes back, her world feels a little worse. She walks to her bedroom door and opens it to find Daniel on the other side, his face grave with concern. She can't read his thinly lidded eyes, but she sees something he's never shown her before, his martial sternness. Sorry to wake you, he says, obviously not sorry. But there's something we need to discuss. Right now. The dim illumination of the night cycle casts the hallways beyond in an eerie red glow. She doesn't bother asking him if it can wait. She knows it can't. Sure, she says. Come on in. She steps aside, but he remains fixed outside her door. When Blue was in high school in New Jersey, she had an internship at a robotics design firm. She'd gotten interested in creating some hobby projects, and because she couldn't afford the servos, she took 5 of them from her office. Then one day, a security guard came to her cubicle and stood before her, just like Daniel stands now.
"Fuck," she says. "Will you come with me to the skiff, please?"
It certainly doesn't look optional. Blue steps into the hall, where she sees Anne standing nearby, a dark look on her face. They fall into a small caravan and make their way down the central strut. She passes the infirmary and glimpses Kambili's still body through the window, his vitals a pulsing nightlight in the shadows. When they reach the docking area, Blue spies the crew of the Athenian, lurking in the darkness, quietly chatting as they share cigarettes. She wonders what they're up to. Maybe they're prepping to launch. Dorian certainly got what he was after. He has all the information he needs to make a case for cleaning out the cold forge. Escape pods line the walls, capable of taking her back to Earth in a sleepy decade. Each pod with space for 2 people. On her worst days, she's thought about climbing into one and launching, hoping that they'll have a cure for her by the time she arrives. There are very few people with her condition, though, so probably not. Civilization has written her off. She has to save herself. But she's failed. That's why they're walking to the skiff in the middle of the night. She wonders if Suddler will force her off the station and onto the Athenian with him, or if she'll have to stay aboard until the next crew rotation, confined to quarters. Maybe he'll trot her before the governance board like a prized pig ready to be slaughtered. Maybe she'll choke on her spit and die of pneumonia before then. When they reach the skiff entryway, he's waiting there, hands in his suit pockets, a professional smile on his face. He relaxes in the floodlights of the great door like an actor on the stage about to deliver a monologue. Lucy, Javier, Dick, and Josep stand nearby as well, looking considerably less pleased. Lucy stares daggers at her. Blue knows it's because of Kambili.
"Good evening, Dr. Marcellus," Suddler says. "We have some questions for you."
Blue smacks her lips. Her android body feels no fatigue, but freshly awakened, she still stretches his muscles.
"I take it we couldn't wait until the morning?"
Anne and Daniel ascend the ramp to enter their access codes and open the door. Blue feels certain her access codes have been revoked, and so doesn't bother to ask if she should help. The buzzer sounds, and the colossal door swings wide as lights flicker to life inside the skiff.
"Care to tell me what this is about?"
"We'll get to it," Suddler replies, ushering all of them inside.
Maybe she should punch him.
She could plow her fist into his nose and snap it before her time here is over. He would, of course, sue her earthly estate to pieces, but what does it matter? She tucks that thought away for later. Like a funeral procession, they pass under Juno's glass cage, headed straight for the kennels.
"Miss Wexler tells me you've maintained an unlicensed server," Suddler says, falling in beside her.
"And I've been asking around. Seems like no one else has heard of it.
Care to render any comments on that?"
She glances over at Anne, who finds somewhere else to look.
"That's my fault," Blue says, careful to keep the edge from her voice. "I told her because I thought it'd make her feel better about the destruction caused by Silver Smile."
Suddler nods.
"I see. So your research is destroyed by Lucy's project, just like everyone else's."
"You lying bitch," Lucy says, shaking her head. "I can't fucking believe you." A flash pops behind Blue's eyes. It's getting harder to keep her temper in check.
"Yeah? Well, where the fuck is it, huh, Lucy? Can you show me? Or are you just going to run your goddamned mouth?
Ladies, Suddler says, his voice stained with irony as he grins at Blue's body. He winks. Please. We can be civil about this, can't we?
All right, that's it, Blue says. I'm so tired of your shit, Suddler. You're seriously going to get all cute about my gender now? You think this is funny, asshole?
Everyone's gaze slews to him, and he shrugs innocently, his shark smile vanishing. Blue gestures toward him.
This is the guy you decided to sleep with, Anne? Really?
But Anne doesn't respond. Lucy closes the gap to Blue, filling her view.
You make it your business to know who everyone is fucking, don't you?
She growls, her big eyes narrowing to slits.
Then you pull your strings and get them hurt.
Lucy's eyebrow twitches upward, and she licks her overlarge lips.
I guess it's your turn now.
Instantly the dots connect. Kambili has decided he has nothing less to lose, and told Lucy where the server is. Suddler probably put pressure on Kambili after hearing about the system from Anne and Josep. He's there to help the others crack it open. Inside, they'll find years of malfeasance. They'll find her research, her journals, her clear and explicit goals of medical application, transmission logs to Elise Cotto, and copies of the cipher used to decrypt Blue's picture messaging. It won't take long before they locate her last received transmission and realize the conspiracy is very much alive. They're going to arrest her for fraud and embezzlement, and she will never see the cure for which she's fought.
I've seen Suddler's private records, Blue says,
her voice shaking and rising out of Marcus's natural range.
He's going to fire all of you. Don't do this for him. Don't. Show some dignity, Dr. Marsalis.
Suddler purses his lips. It's all crashing down. If ever there were a time to break the man's face, it's now. She takes three quick steps toward him.
Marcus, engage override Epsilon, he says.
Her leg locks in place. She feels herself say, override confirmed, locking out pilot controls. Suddler jams his hands into his pockets and saunters over, nose wrinkling in a grin. He clucks his tongue. I can't believe you were going to hit me.
I would never strike a human, sir, Blue says, even as she strains to control the muscles in her throat.
Of course not, he says, clapping her on the shoulder. That's because you're company property. Now go back to synthetic storage, and shut down, if you please. We'll take it from here.
Yes, sir. Very good.
Dorian sighs. I've got to say, I like this side of you, Blue. 11. Viable countermeasures. They found the hidden data port in the server behind the wall panel down one of the utility corridors, just as Kambili said they would. Dorian stares at the set of metal boxes, happier than he's been in a long time. Companies aren't about providing a service to the people who work there. They aren't about social progress or any of that other bullshit. Companies are about maintaining the balance of profit to expansion and winning. Two things which Dorian has done handily. Get the text from Rose Eagle and Silver Smile up here, Dorian says to Anne. I want her results ready to take back to Earth by tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Anne shakes her head.
Do you really think that was an appropriate way to handle her? How can she not understand the expert maneuvering that's brought them to this victory? How can she possibly question him, especially at that moment?
Dorian glances around the hall and surveys the reaction. To his dismay, Lucy seems to be the only one pleased with the way this is playing out.
fury grows within him. Anne's words are like grease on a precious diamond. They could be easily wiped away, but he's shocked someone put them there in the first place. His hands shake with disbelief.
"She's a thief, you idiot!"
he roars. Then he pauses, takes a deep breath, and gets his voice under control. "Every single egg sample she misappropriated was worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Every adult snatcher rotting in a cell is worth a million. Glitter Edifice has a net value 16 times that of Rose Eagle and 100 times the price of Silver Smile. Dr. Marsalis's kennels are the only reason any of these other people are here." He sweeps his hand over the assembled crowd.
"We were very successful," Lucy protests.
"At fucking everything up." Anger starts to burn again.
"And you did a good fucking job." "Blue wasn't lying, was she?"
Anne asks.
"You're going to fire everyone."
"No," Dorian says. "But I am making a lot of transfers. Starting with you. Just about everyone here is too good for this place. I want to move you to Tokyo, Miss Wexler, where your talents will be better utilized." As a security member, her talents are basically non-existent. She's failed to contain any threats, and he has trouble imagining Anne Wexler or Commander Cardozo repelling hostile borders. At this point, he needs her, however, and the Tokyo office is an effective carrot. He can always betray her after he has what he needs.
"What about us?" Lucy asks.
Dorian pauses to consider his response. The company will never again require Lucy's services. After the Silver Smile debacle, he's going to blacklist her so she can't get as much as an interview.
She's through.
"Ms. Biltmore, I'm not going to fire any project managers. No doubt you'll fit in at our Berkeley Technology Incubator. Mr. Janos, we've got numerous cryptography postings." Dorian lifts a hand to fend off any questions. "These are details that are better left for later. We all have a job to do, and I want that goddamned research." His voice rises. "Do I make myself clear?" Before they can respond, he adds, "I presume you all understand that Dr. Blue Marsalis will no longer be employed by the company. Her clearance is revoked. She is to be prevented from having any further access to vital station assets." He turns away, indicating that the discussion is at an end. The techs arrive, as do reheated pizza and sodas from the lounge. Whatever they're doing, the various programmers settle in for a hard couple of hours. A makeshift lab pops up around the wall panel they removed to locate the server, complete with portable terminals, folding tables, and dozens of food wrappers. There are several members of the crew Dorian has never met. They introduce themselves to him as if he should care. The camaraderie between the low-ranking workers flourishes as they laugh and pore over the problem. Even Blue's low-level techs are in evidence, helping with the effort, expressing shock and dismay, providing insights into their former boss's mindset. What began as a couple of managers standing around a hole in the wall transforms into a war room. These are people working for the ledgers, and Dorian feels the pendulum swinging away from chaos. Balance will return to the Cold Forge, though he'll be damned if it continues under the same management. With such colossal losses assessed against each project, this place is a gold mine. If his new appointees get the RB-232 back on track, his bonus will be of celestial proportions. Still, it's hard not to love chaos sometimes. His money results from terrible management and bad decisions, from the failure of others. And he's grateful that his job only sends him to places that are massive blunders. He always longs to be closest to the raging wildfire. The day cycle wears on into night,
and the texts show no signs of a breakthrough. When he asks Lucy about their progress, he gets only non-committal mumbling and technical jargon. So he asks Josip. Blue's research is carefully locked through quantum cryptography, something Rose Eagle can break, he's assured. They have men and women trying to get the Entangler back online. It's been hours. They don't need him to hover, so Dorian wanders off into the kennels, toward parts he's never seen before. He visits egg storage, marveling at the robust countermeasures placed on the egg boxes. He commandeers one of the techs to show him video of an early impregnation. All of the later ones are stored on Blue's secret server. They sit down together at one of the chem lab workstations, and the video begins to play. A chimp lies strapped before a stony oval the size of a large garden vase. The egg blooms at the top like a flower, its meaty white insides almost delicate. A call pulls aside, and the creature springs forth, almost too fast to see until it lands a deadly blow. This is the claw he saw floating in the lab. He leans toward the monitor for a better look and counts 8 fleshy articulating fingers with bony joints like those of an old woman. The whip-like tail lashes out, folding around the anthropoid's neck to choke it out with negligible effort. The chimp strains against its straps and falls still. How long can those creatures survive outside the eggs? Dorian asks. The tech shrugs, clearly uncomfortable with being spoken to. We've never checked, sir. Wouldn't have wanted to waste one by letting it die. How strong are their tail muscles? About as strong as a boa constrictor, I guess. Dorian scoffs. Is that what passes for a unit of measurement? What tests have you run? I don't, think, the tech stammers. I don't know. And what did you do when you worked on this project? I made sure the sequencers ran correctly and logged everything for Dr. Okoro and Dr. Marsalis. I see. Show me a video of the birth. The tech keys in a few codes. Do I not work here anymore? He asks. Dorian shakes his head. I guess that depends on whether or not I can get you to show me some simple videos, doesn't it? Birth. Now. Get a move on. The tech quickly finishes his query and brings up footage of the same chimp, strapped to a different table. Its hair is matted at the back, where the spider's fingers gripped it hard enough to break skin. Its eyes flutter open, and it looks confused. What happened to the claw thing? Dorian asks. The facehugger? It slips off after a day or so and dies. We find them withered up on their backs. Abruptly, the chimp cries out on screen, and Dorian jumps. His full attention returns to the video. The animal shakes and screams, frothy saliva blowing from its throat and covering its face like snowflakes. It struggles against the restraints, terror etched on its face, then freezes as though it's having a grand mal seizure. A lump rises in the skin of its belly, and Dorian's breath catches. The lump stretches thin until a phallic protrusion breaks the surface in a spraying gout of blood. The chimp convulses once more, then goes limp. The fleshy worm-like creature stands upright, its long arms questing into the air as they drip with blood and mucus. Its tiny teeth glisten as though made of metal, and it screams aloud, the sound of steam hissing from a small pipe. Oh, the tech says, interrupting Dorian's reverie. We did, you know, run an autopsy and find that the hosts were iron deficient. So we think, like maybe the Snatcher scrapes metals from the host bloodstream. We're calling that stage the, chest burster.
Very literal names you've got here. No poetry. Footsteps. Dick Mackey steps over the threshold behind them, a beer in each hand.
That's what came with our source documentation. Shipped with the samples. No species names. No indicated origins. Just egg, facehugger, chestburster. We had to name the big buggers ourselves.
Yeah. Snatchers. Wouldn't have been my first choice.
You're welcome to come up with something better.
Dick passes one of the beers to Dorian, and he checks it out. It's a shitty American Pilsner, but Dorian hasn't had a beer in ages, so he's grateful. It's unopened, which is a relief. He often wonders if a crew would have the balls to try and do away with him. On screen, the chestburster burrows back into its host, and rivers of blood and bile pour from the chimp's open chest cavity. The animal's body jolts as the chestburster gnaws its way upward. Dick waves away the tech, who seems all too happy to leave.
Two things about the chestbursters, mate. One, they can't find a hole in their cages. They dig in and eat for a day. Two, they take on the characteristics of the host. All of the adults in our cages have got chimp proportions, and they favor loping on all fours. They don't look like the file drawings that Weyland-Yutani sent with the egg samples.
How so? Dick takes a long swig of his beer, then winks.
Those drawings had human proportions, Cobba. Wouldn't want to be the poor sod who discovered these things.
Dorian feels a pang of jealousy toward the chimpanzee. He has no desire to die, but he imagines leaving his genetic legacy to such a worthy beast as the Snatcher. He has never wanted a child, but he briefly imagines the creature that might come from his DNA, and it gives him chills.
You seem like a man who appreciates these animals for what they are, Dick observes.
The beer is cool on Dorian's lips, and the sugar and yeast bring him calm after a rough day.
They're fine art.
Plain and simple. Predation perfected. Dick winks.
Thought you might say that.
He keys in another code, and the monitors all switch to the live broadcasts from inside the cells.
It's feeding time. Why don't you kick back here, while me and the boys handle the rest?
Pleased with Dick's offer, Dorian puts his feet up on the table and sips his beer, sharp eyes scanning every monitor for signs of activity. Within a few minutes, a small slit opens up on each cell, and chunks of bloody meat pour inside. Each creature's routine is the same. Attack the slit, grab the meat, gorge upon it with jaws distended. Their bloody hands rove their bodies as they eat, covering themselves with gore like birds bathing in a fountain. He watches them for hours. These marvelous children of the stars. And slowly, Dorian drifts off into a peaceful slumber. Interlude. Lucy.
Where were you?
The young woman asks as Lucy comes huffing up the stairs into Juno's cage. It's Carrie, one of the Silver Smile techs.
Lucy stammers, catching her breath. Just checking on the progress of Blue's server decryption.
Carrie smirks.
Girl, you really got it in for her. Screw her.
Lucy takes a sip of diet soda.
This whole station is going to be better after she's gone.
She checks her watch again. Everything is taking too long. She's ready to get the fuck out of here.
I'm just saying we ought to stick together,
Carrie says. It shocks Lucy to hear her talking that way. They've been working together for a few years, moving from project to project, and Carrie is always the first to go knives out.
That's the problem.
Lucy reclines in her chair, tipping the can toward Carrie as though it was a beer.
She wished to God it was a whiskey and coke. She could certainly use one.
We were sticking together. She played us all, and now look at us.
Carrie gives her a concerned look. Lucy has been getting too many of those lately.
You want to change the subject?
Carrie asks.
How is your mom, anyway? Still worried about her? She's fine,
Lucy snaps back, because if she talks about her mother after what she's been doing on the Cold Forge, she's going to cry.
Let's just stick to the task at hand.
Juno's server chamber is normally the nicest room in the whole skiff, and the best place to relax. There are no exterior windows in this part of the station, but Juno's command view over the central area gives it a panoramic feeling. Plus, the chairs are a lot cushier than the ones in the lab. She's caught Javier sleeping here plenty of times.
Don't you think we're a little to blame for this situation?
Carrie asks, raising an eyebrow.
I wrote the code for the flash tool. Maybe I ought to be fired.
What? No, Lucy says. Javier should have checked the tool before plugging it into a main.
And you'd better watch what you say. If Director Sudler heard you talk like that...
She runs a thumbnail across her throat like a knife.
Maybe I want to get fired,
Carrie persists, standing and moving to the next bank of readouts. She unslings a portable terminal from her shoulder, flips it open, and begins checking numbers.
Or just, you know, laid off. I'm tired of this shithole, Lucy. I want to go home.
But Lucy doesn't agree. She'd broken up with her last boyfriend before taking the assignment. He wanted marriage and a baby. She wanted freedom. And on the Cold Forge, Lucy met Kumbili. The sex was good, consistent, and without obligation, and after a few months of it, she'd begun to understand why people wanted children. On Earth, she'd be nothing to Kumbili. Mrs. Okoro claimed the entire planet, and her husband, for herself. In the light of Kaufman, Lucy can be anything she wants for him. His bandaged face springs to her mind. Even with the latest medical science, Kumbili will never look the same again. She considers all the long nights they've spent talking. The way he looks at her after they make love, and she knows she will lie with him again after the bandages come off. She loves him, and soon they'll all be going home. A bitter part of Lucy hopes Kumbili's wife will cast him aside when they arrive.
Shit,
Carrie says, pulling Lucy back into the present.
Motherfucking bullshit! What? How the fuck did it get back out?
Carrie frantically types in queries and checks the results, eyes raking desperately over the display.
All our hard work!
Lucy sits up, taking her feet off the desk.
How did what get out? Silver Smile!
Carrie glances over to Lucy.
Juno just lost comms with the kennels.
Lucy shakes her head.
Got to be a bug with the reinitialization. We scrubbed those drives thoroughly. This is a factory fresh cloud. Well, okay, but that means Javier didn't get the lines working like he said he did.
Her voice is a combination of anger and something else. Fear. Lucy rolls her eyes.
I double-checked, and Javier can't afford to make any mistakes. I know he did it right.
Carrie puts her terminal down and slides it toward Lucy, where it almost knocks over her soda. Lucy has never seen her tech so worked up, and it's almost comical. She smiles and leans over the terminal, certain that there is a rational explanation.
The cells aren't wired up,
Carrie says, pointing to a row of red NSC icons lining the side of the screen.
They're showing no status connection errors.
Lucy blinks at the screen. It's true. The table header indicates the kennel cells, but that can't be right. It had better not be right. She types in a query and pings the central cell database gateway. It pongs quickly and reliably.